Hi there, esteemed audience, and welcome to another episode of Middle Grade Ninja. I'm your host, Rob Gant. As you know, I'm the author of Banneker Bones and the Giant Robot Bees, which is available now as an audiobook, a paperback, and the ebook is free. Yes, free to download whenever you're watching or listening to us, wherever fine ebooks are sold. Under the super secret pen name Robert Kent, I've written some young adult novels for older readers. You can find out more about those, more about me, and more importantly, interviews with thousands of literary agents, editors, authors, publicists, book people, the world's best people at middlegradeninja.com. I couldn't be more excited to welcome Kristen Ostby to the program. Kristen, how are you this morning?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for making the time. Esteemed audience knows that I never summarize anybody else's book or anybody else's background. How painful for you to have to sit there while I fumble through that. So the best place to start is if you would give a esteemed audience an overview of your background.
Sure thing. Yeah. So I am a literary agent at the Greenhouse Literary Agency. And I began my career in publishing as an editorial intern and then an editorial assistant at Penguin. And was there for several years working in mass market publishing, working on everything from movie and TV tie-ins to Mad Libs, and some middle grade series as well. And from there, I moved to Albert Whitman and Company, where I spent about a year, working on more school and library titles. And then I moved over into trade publishing at Simon & Schuster Books for Young Readers, where I really sort of got to work on everything from picture books through YA, focusing really on middle grade and on picture books in particular. And I spent a couple of years doing some freelance editing and writing. I do a lot of work for hired writing, and I have done since the beginning of my career. And then about a year ago came to agenting at Greenhouse, which was something I thought about doing for a really long time. And it's been a blast so far, and I'm really enjoying this new side of the industry.
So hopefully I'm catching you just as you're a year in, you're still actively building your list and eager to sign all of my audience who's listening closely for details about what they need to do to be represented by you. But already an incredibly impressive career thus far, and only to become more impressive going forward, I'm sure. Let's go back a little bit. I love a good origin story, and so does esteemed audience. You are the daughter of a librarian, which I assume factors into your love of reading.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, we read tons growing up. My mom was always bringing home the latest ALA award winners, and I definitely, definitely fostered a love of reading in me. And yeah, I mean, I just have always been interested in books. Both as, you know, both in reading them and as a product. And I just love this industry as a result. Yeah.
Do you remember what were some of, this is an impossible question and I acknowledge that, but what were some of your favorite books growing up?
Yeah. So the ones that stand out to me the most, when I was particularly small, I really loved Corduroy. That was the one book that I had my mom read over and over and over and over again. It's burned into my memory. I just loved that book. It was always so magical to me. So that was, I would say, my favorite picture book for sure. And then I mentioned my mom would always bring home, you know, the ALA award-winning books. When she brought home Walk Two Moons for me, that book just changed my life. I remember devouring it, and it's kind of all of the things I really still want in a middle grade novel. And Sharon Creech is just such an astonishing author. Those are two of the highlights. There are many, many more, but those are kind of two of my all-time favorites.
So were you a voracious reader? Did you always have a book in your hand?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, I remember walking up and downstairs with my nose in a book, now my eldest daughter is six, and she'll, you know, walk to the bus stop and she'll have her nose in a book, and I go, oh, that's, she got that from me. But yeah, absolutely. I read all the time, and still do when I'm not reading manuscripts. Love to read. So yeah, absolutely.
And you became a writer, but did you first want to be an author? Did you want to work in publishing, or just a little bit of everything?
You know, I always loved the idea of writing, and always enjoyed doing it in school. And I don't know that it really ever occurred to me that I could work in publishing until much later when I was in college and I was an English major trying to figure out what I wanted to do, and was visiting a friend here in New York. We went to the public library, the main branch with the two big lions out front, and we were in the bookshop, in the gift shop, and I gravitated towards the kids' books as I always have done. And my friend was the one who said to me at the time, have you ever thought about working in children's publishing? And I thought, oh, that's a great idea. I should do that. So I owe her a lot of credit for really putting that in my head, because it never really, you know, occurred to me that that was something I could do for a living. It kind of brought together all the things that that I really like. So yeah, it wasn't something that seemed obvious right away, but once it clicked into place, it made all the sense in the world.
It's one of those things, it seems almost like an impossible dream here in the Midwest, the thought of you're there in Michigan, and you're going to go to New York, and you're going to become, a senior editor with Penguin Random House, and then Simon and Schuster. So how do you make that move?
How do I make the move to living in New York?
To living to New York, and then to getting yourself into a position where you can rise to that status.
Yeah. So when I was a junior in college, I applied for internships and was fortunate enough to get one at Penguin and came out and spent a summer out here, was fortunate enough to be able to do that. And then the following year, when I was graduating from college, they happened to have an editorial assistant position open up and called me up. And so I moved out here 2 weeks after college graduation and started to work for Penguin. So a lot of things just kind of lined up. And I was very, very lucky that way. I just kind of never really looked back. As I mentioned, I started out in mass market publishing and really wanted to make the move over into trade books and working on novels and picture books. And that was something that I think took a bit of work to sort of maneuver from mass market publishing over into that side of things. But I'm really glad I was able to, and I think it gave me so much experience. That's both working in mass market publishing and in trade publishing has given me so much experience. It's been so invaluable. And I think in agenting in particular has been really informative.
So obviously anybody who sends you a query and who's lucky enough to be selected is going to benefit from all of those years of experience working within publishing. When you move from mass market over to trade, is that just a matter of obviously excelling at your current position and then networking and looking for the openings when they come?
Yeah, it was. I think a lot of networking made a big difference. And I think the fact that I was able to work at Albert Whitman & Company, which is a very small publisher. And like I said, they do mostly school and library. That's their market primarily. But, you know, they're hardcover picture books, middle grade novels and young adult novels. And I think transitioning to a small place I was able to sort of get my sea legs with working on more trade-like titles. And so that was, I think, a big part of it. And then a friend of mine from Penguin was the one who sent me the job listing for the Books for Young Readers position at SNS. And I think all the things kind of came together because they were looking for somebody who could do not only trade titles, but sort of their more crash titles that they were looking to publish quickly. And given my mass market experience, we had to crash out projects frequently, and we were given very short deadlines to kind of punch books out. And so when we had like a book by a celebrity author, for example, and they wanted to get it out right away, I'd had that training to sort of do things more speedily as well. So I think that was really helpful in moving over to SNS. And then I had the opportunity to do all kinds of different books there.
And I seems like I'm bringing this up every episode because it's been on my mind, and I know it's on the mind of lots of authors who've been paying attention. We've had some recent high profile exits by associate editors, I believe, who let us all know through social media that the industry could improve some things. Now, I know you and I are talking, 7-8 years ago? Or no longer than that.
Yeah. Since moving over to SNS. Oh, I started at SNS in 2012, I believe. Yeah. As an editor. Yeah.
And see, that's a reminder, esteemed audience, why I don't summarize other people's backgrounds. Look at what a mess I make of it. But I'm sure that at that time, salaries were much different. But did you find coming in that you could do that job just working that job, or did you need to get a second job? How were you able to make finances?
Yeah. I mean, I, like I said, I've always done freelance work for hire writing. And for a long time, I did freelance copy editing and proofreading too. And I had done that pretty much since I was an assistant on, and that was how I was able to, you know, pay my rent and afford to do some extra things that I wouldn't have on just that salary alone. I think once I started SNS, I pulled back on doing freelance work at that point in time, and was able to, you know, do just fine on my own salary. But yeah, I mean, it definitely was, you know, not always easy to have to bring work home in the evenings and on weekends, and from my actual job, but also squeeze in freelance work on the side. So it was a lot of working, you know, all of the time, pretty much. So I definitely empathize very deeply with everybody who's going through so much burnout right now. And it's something that really needs addressing. And I hope people are thinking about critically how to help folks in editorial, and to provide opportunities for people who are less privileged and who really, you know, can't just survive on a meager publishing salary.
Well, if I gave you a magic wand, and I said fix publishing, what are you going to do that takes care of the issue?
Well, I mean, gosh, it's magic wand.
The premise of the question is you have that ability, and we're going to focus on publishing, but still.
For sure.
To fix the larger world, let's focus on this one.
Fair enough. Yeah. I mean, in thinking about editorial specifically, I mean, I always say, I mean, an editor, anybody in editorial is doing at least two jobs. And oftentimes more, and their editors are doing the work, they're doing marketing work, they're doing, they're liaising with sales and publicity, and a lot of editors don't actually get to edit at work, and they're editing at home and on the weekends and reading submissions at home and on the weekends. And so I think to me, if editors were able to reclaim editing and reading submissions as their day job, I think that would be a huge help. I think at least then editors wouldn't feel, and you know, everyone from editorial assistants to associate editors wouldn't feel as though, you know, the task alone was impossible. And then of course there's pay. And I feel like, you know, that either you scale back the work and pay appropriately for that, or you pay for the amount of work you're actually asking for, which is far more than like I said, one job. So, I mean, I think there are a lot of different solutions potentially. And I think a lot of them involve, paying people what they're due for the hard work that they do. And this is something I talk about with my friends all the time, because it's such an ongoing issue. And I think anyone who's been there knows how tough it is.
But now that you are working on the agent side of things, that gives you a unique advantage because you know what the editors are going through. I'm assuming you have lots of contacts within the big houses from your time there.
Yeah. I definitely do empathize with what they're going through. When I send out submissions, I know that they have a lot on their plate. I spoke to an editor yesterday who said she'd received 500 submissions this year so far alone, which is astonishing. When someone is not able to read something right away, I certainly understand why that's the case. And I know that it takes that much more effort to, get an editor's attention. So I think that's one thing that my editorial background helps with too, is really knowing how to position something for an editor so that they are going to want to pay attention to it more quickly than something else that might be coming through. I think that experience in working with marketing and working with sales and publicity really helps to sort of position a manuscript so that they can see how they might then parlay it to that team if they want to acquire it too.
And I should point out for esteemed audience who knows that we record these episodes and then they come out around author release dates. And so whenever you're listening to this, we're recording this right here at the end of April. So 500 submissions before even the halfway point of the year.
Yeah, I know. It's really incredible. Yeah, it's a lot. They're getting a lot. And there are a lot of agents these days too. So, you know, the competition is stiff. So I think the contacts are definitely helpful in my shoes right now. That's for sure.
So when we're talking 500 submissions, are we talking those are all agented submissions that get through to an editor? Are those...
I believe so. Yeah, this was somebody at a house that I don't believe takes unagented submissions. So that was my understanding. But yeah. I know. It's a lot for sure. Yeah. So having an agent who can pitch you well is definitely key.
So I mean, you know, I always take a little bit of comfort in knowing that overflowing inboxes for agents are, you know, filled with a lot of people who just haven't done the work yet, haven't listened to this show.
Yes.
And so they're not clued in, and they're not putting their best foot forward. And I feel confident that anybody listening to this show is head and shoulders above them, not going to have a problem. But 500 agented submissions, that's a little bit different.
For sure. And this was somebody who was relatively new to their company. And so I'm sure, you know, there are people who were really excited that they had somebody with a fresh list to submit to. So perhaps that's higher than other editors, you know, it's hard to say. But yeah, it's definitely not a joke. And explains, I think, the burnout to a large degree too, because that's just so hard to stay on top of that quantity of reading, especially when you're reading other editors' manuscripts that they're thinking of bringing on board and you're working on your ongoing projects. Finding that space to read is a challenge sometimes.
So when did you decide that you would be better positioned to help authors as a literary agent rather than an editor?
Yeah, so, sorry?
I said, or have you decided that?
Yes. I had thought agenting seemed appealing for a long time, and I never really was quite sure how to make that switch. And I was enjoying editing too. I actually took a step back from full-time editing in 2016. This kind of relates back to the burnout question to a degree too. I came back to Simon & Schuster after having my first daughter. After my maternity leave, I came back to work and just found that the workload, in addition to having a newborn child, was just untenable. Like, I didn't know how to edit or read at home anymore when I had a small baby to take care of. And it was difficult. And I had a very large list of titles. It's certainly doable, and plenty of, I think, editors are parents and make it work, but it's a challenge. And so I was, again, fortunate enough to be able to take a step back from full-time work, and I freelance edited for Simon & Schuster, and I did freelance writing work for a number of years on the side while raising my oldest and having a second child, and then decided to look to get back into publishing. And I figured I'd get an editorial job again, and then was fortunate enough to get connected with Chelsea Eberle and Sarah Davies at Greenhouse, who were looking to bring someone on board. And it was just kind of the perfect chance to try something new. And it seemed like a great time to try something new, to sort of stretch myself and use the skills I'd gained as an editor to do this. And I think one of the things I enjoyed the most about being an editor was the relationships I had with my authors and illustrators. I mean, I got so much joy out of that. And both working with them collaboratively and advocating for them. And you know, those were the parts of my job that, again, brought me the most joy. So for me, getting the chance to do that in a more sort of intense way was really appealing. And to be able to, like, I think the act of discovery, also being able to find writers and feel like I had that connection with their work initially, and then can work with them to get something to go out on submission. And I think it's just a different kind of a connection. And I think it's a really nice one too. And it's just, I think it's really fun to be more on that advocacy side of the job. And to be able to connect them with a publishing home is so gratifying too, because this is a dream for so many people, as you know. And so to be able to be a part of that is really thrilling. So for me, it's been, I think, a really great transition, and one that I'm really enjoying so far as that part of things goes.
Well, I know esteemed audience is chomping at the bit to know, so we can't let them wait any longer. What types of projects are you seeking?
Yeah, so I am looking for primarily middle grade and young adult fiction right now. I am looking for, as far as the genre, I think I'm focusing mostly on contemporary, on light fantasy or magical middle grade. I'm interested in mysteries, and could go on and on as far as the kinds of things I really love in that category, but those are some of the highlights for middle grade. And YA, again, I think I'd love to find some contemporary. I'm really interested in rom-com. I'm interested in speculative fiction too. And really mostly first and foremost, just looking for really great writing. I think if someone's writing can suck me into a story, it really doesn't matter what the genre is. So I'm just really right now when I'm reading queries, just looking to get sucked into a story, more or less. And that's sort of my guiding principle. And I'm also looking for picture book author illustrators. So people who are illustrators who can write as well. And I'm very eagerly looking for stuff right now. So I hope that your esteemed audience will submit me their queries, because I'm very, very excited to find new stuff. I'm very much building my list right now. So can't wait to see great stuff come my way. And my inbox, I'm, you know, actually almost caught up with at the moment. And it's been, so every time something comes in, I'm right on top of it, looking for great new things.
Out of curiosity, year one, how many queries are you finding that you're receiving a day, a week, whatever?
I'm probably getting maybe like, I want to say 25 a day, something like that. They pile up pretty quickly. I am able at this point to spend about an hour each morning going through them and requesting any fulls I would like to request. Very much kind of looking for that next exciting thing at the moment.
Well, I will endeavor to get that up to 50, 60 a day.
Hey, please.
The podcast, let Kristen know how you heard about her. You're looking for, you're primarily seeking voicey, character-driven middle grade. What does voicey mean?
I mean, it's something that could be interpreted different ways, but I guess, you know, the thing with middle grade is it's so rare to find that really great middle grade voice, someone who really captures that age group. And I think, you know, some writers can make the mistake of sort of writing down to middle graders, but I think someone who really can recognize that children in that category are really capable of, they have a great sense of humor, and they are capable of reading about subjects that are, you know, maybe what some might consider, you know, darker than what they might think kids that age are capable of reading. So when I think of voicey, I think of, it's sort of a nebulous thing that is just about the quality of the writing and being able to make me believe that the narrator, you know, has their own sort of like character or personality coming through in the prose, if that makes sense. I think it really comes down to like quality of the prose for me. And again, sort of like a character to the writing coming through, as opposed to kind of just like a straightforward writing style, if that makes sense.
Okay. So the narration itself should almost be its own character within the story?
In a way, or it's the writer's personality coming through, I think is what that can be oftentimes.
Okay, fair enough. And you're looking for, I love this phrase, unabashedly intersectional overtones.
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
I guess I mean that I don't want people to shy away from talking about the intersection of different identities in their work. And I don't necessarily think it has to be the central subject of the story, although it can be. I want to see... I want to see stories that have, you know, feminist representation, or that push the envelope in some way. I, of course, want to see stories from writers of all different backgrounds, and for that to be a huge part of the story that they're telling, and really inform the story that they're telling. I'm really interested in fresh ways to tell stories from different people's perspectives, whatever that might mean.
esteemed audience, I want to talk about your interest for YA also. Don't worry, esteemed audience. But esteemed audience knows that I ask every publishing professional who comes on the show about diversity in traditional publishing. We have seen an admirable push, I think, to increase diversity in traditional publishing. We all know what the issue has been. So my question is simply, what are you seeing publishing doing to continue to address that? And what are you and Greenhouse Literary doing to increase diversity in publishing?
Yeah, absolutely. I think publishers are making more of an effort to hire editors from different backgrounds. Editors who are not white primarily, which I think is hugely important, but also editors from different gender identities, and just trying to diversify. And there's still a lot more work to be done, but I think there does seem to be a concerted effort, at least I've seen in editorial specifically, to do that. And I think certainly, I mean, in talking to editors, you know, almost every editor that I speak to is making a really concerted effort to diversify their lists and are prioritizing stories by people from a marginalized or underrepresented backgrounds. And it's really heartening to see that. I think editors are very largely responsible for, you know, the you know, whenever I pop into a bookstore, BNN or an indie or what have you, I mean, the display tables really do look different now than they did 6 years ago. I mean, I really think you see such a broader array of stories being told. And I think that's, again, heartening. And there's still so much work to be done. And there are some really important conversations that are still happening. But I'm very glad to see that. And from Greenhouse's perspective, I mean, I think it's sort of a similar thing. We're making a really concerted effort to look for stories that are untold, or and looking for clients who may not have had, who, you know, deserve to have their stories told, and really looking to make sure that our range of clients represents a diverse group of people. Yeah.
Makes sense to me. Maybe I'll bring that magic wand back and we'll figure out how to fix this problem.
Yeah, please.
And you know what? Once we fix all of publishing, maybe we'll look at the economy, democracy. Yeah, there's some
one thing at a time. Yeah.
So as far as young adult goes, I know that you said you're big on mysteries. You're looking for lots of things that have twists and theme. I'm sorry, twists and turns. Why am I telling you what you want? What do you want for young adult?
Yeah. So I am kind of. I would say I'm looking for writing that I connect with first and foremost in YA. I think contemporary YA is something I'm particularly interested in. I'm interested in contemporary YA stories that are being told a little bit differently, whether it's a different framework, you know, maybe it's not a linear storytelling style, maybe someone's playing with that, or someone is playing with the narrator, maybe it's, you know, whether it's an unreliable narrator or an unexpected narrator. And I'm really interested in rom-com. I think, you know, anything that is escapist, I think in YA for me is sort of where it's at. As far as fantasy goes, I'm interested in maybe accessible fantasy, or maybe sort of more YA that's more on the magical side. As far as like high fantasy, that's not quite my thing as much as I would like it to be. I haven't quite found my way in high fantasy just yet. I do get a lot of submissions that are fantasy. I'm looking for, I would love to find a great thriller or a great YA mystery. You know, again, escapist stuff that, like, you know, just kind of takes you away from the more serious things that I think teens are having to deal with all the time. And that's not to say I'm not interested in things that are, you know, that take on important issues. I certainly am. I think I just like to see them maybe couched in an escapist story where kids can see themselves represented in something that is lighthearted, or if not lighthearted, at least sort of fun and a riveting read, if that makes sense.
Gotcha. That makes sense to me. So, esteemed audience, if you've written a riveting book and you're looking for who is the agent, well, by God.
Yes, send me all the riveting things.
Something I wanted to ask you about. You had mentioned that you adore middle grade on your manuscript wish list page. I can't speak. You adore middle grade that uses humor as a tool to reveal funny unspoken truths about kids' experiences with like heavier themes about family life for the world at large. And I have seen that done well, and I have seen that done really heavy-handed in a way you can't miss it. So with all of your years of experience as an editor, how would you advise your clients to be able to pull that off but not become so heavy-handed?
Yeah, I think, yeah, light touch is easier said than done, for sure. And it's definitely an art. And I think one of the reasons I mentioned humor is I think that's a great way to sort of alleviate, may not be the right word, but to alleviate sort of the heavy-handedness that could come with addressing heavier topics. And I think, Walk Two Moons, I mentioned earlier by Sharon Creech, one of the reasons it's one of my favorite middle grade novels is that it's so funny and it's so quirky and the characters are so great and three-dimensional and well-developed. And, but the heart of the story is tragic. It's incredibly sad. And you don't fully, as a reader, as a middle grader, you don't fully know, spoiler alert, it's about the loss of a parent. And it handles it in such a way that you're laughing the whole way through until, suddenly you're sort of like have the rug pulled out from under you and you have that it gives you the space to, I think, feel all of those emotions that come with something like that without feeling like it's being forced upon you or like you're being manipulated, if that makes sense. I think one of the things I hate to feel like is that someone is trying to pull my heartstrings in a way. I think when it's done in a way that it's an art, and I don't know that I can even instruct a writer how exactly to do it in a quick way. But I think that humor is a great way to sort of get a reader to stick along with you on a topic that is more difficult to handle. I mean, I think it's similar to how like a stand-up comedian could talk about really dark stuff, but they're making you laugh. And so you're willing to listen to them talk about it. I feel like it's kind of a similar thing.
Gotcha. I love the idea of how do I write a brilliant novel? 2 minutes or less, go. Humor is also so wonderful for horror stories as well, because if we're laughing, we're having fun, we stopped worrying for a moment, which is the perfect time to terrify your audience.
True, it's totally true. Absolutely, yes, for sure.
Let your guard down? Oh, wonderful. That's yes. What I was hoping for.
Exactly.
Are you interested? I know YA mystery and suspense. Are you interested in horror at all?
I am interested in horror. In fact, one of my clients has a spooky, light horror middle grade that I'm working on right now. And I'm very interested in horror, I think particularly in middle grade, in part because I'm a total chicken when it comes to horror, and middle grade horror I can stand to work on without getting terrified. But I think, potentially I'm interested in it in YA as well. I think it's having such a moment right now, which is great and exciting and makes so much sense, because horror is a very safe space to explore the scary feelings that so many of us are feeling just existing in the world right now. So I think I'm really glad to kind of see it have a bit of a renaissance right now. And yes, definitely interested in horror. Yeah, for sure.
Well, I saw that you'd mentioned one of the next books that you'd love to find or something similar is The Witches by Roald Dahl, which I consider to be the scariest middle grade novel ever written.
Very creepy stuff. Yeah.
Also problematic. Check out my conversation with Kyle Lukoff, esteemed audience, as he breaks down exactly why that book is so problematic, but it's also very, very scary.
Yeah, I would be interested to, I'll have to check out that conversation. I reread the beginning of that book not too long ago, and I haven't read it in full, so I'll have to kind of read it again with an eye to that. I'd be curious to know more. But I mean, yeah, Roald Dahl is problematic for a number of reasons, so I can sort of imagine why. But I mean, the thing with The Witches and with Roald Dahl generally is that he was not afraid to go dark. And I think that's something I love to see in middle grade, is people not really shying away from kids, darker feelings, because kids that age certainly do, feel the same spectrum of emotions that we adults do. And there's really no reason, I don't think, to try to shield them from that. And I think one thing I like about Roald Dahl and The Witches in particular is how the darkness and the humor sort of fuse together in a really interesting way. And I think that's what I would really love to see.
Another great, I've already put the disclaimer out there, so now I can talk about how much I love about Roald Dahl. And esteemed audience is probably sick of me sticking up for him, but I'd like to point out that he lived in a different time. Lots of people were racist and sexist at that time. They didn't all write The Witches or Charlie the Chocolate Factory. We'll focus on his more admirable qualities. And something I love about that book, and it makes me think of Boyce Middle Grade, is that the narrator does become a character, and it's a little bit reassuring because that narrator is there talking directly to us from the beginning. Even though we're going to see some really scary stuff, I know that funny narrator is going to be there with me through parts of it.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Yeah, I mean, I think it's just like having, you know, if you're being told a story in person and you trust that person, then you're more willing to get carried along for the ride. I think that's a great point. Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm assuming that over the years you've had contact with any number of literary agents. You know who, I'm assuming you get a sense of who are the better agents, who's sending me the quality stuff, and who are the also great agents, but slightly less great than these over here. And I imagine that when you decide you want to become a literary agent, you've got probably more options than somebody who hasn't been in the industry for as long as you have with some of the successes you've had. What is it about the Greenhouse Literary Agency that made you think, yes, this is where I want to be?
Yeah, so Greenhouse was founded about 15 years ago by Sarah Davies, who recently retired. And she was publishing, she was an editor in her own right, a publishing executive in the UK, and really came to found this agency with this huge wealth of knowledge. I think also really, you know, sort of formed it in her image of being somebody who is, you know, an agent who is incredibly respectful and thoughtful and kind and I think that it's, Greenhouse is it's an established agency. It's a reputable agency that I think has a sort of a brand of trustworthiness to it. And I knew Greenhouse, I knew Sarah before she and Chelsea Eberle, who has now taken over the agency, came to me, and we had our conversations before I came on board. And I knew Greenhouse's stellar reputation and thought, I'd be so lucky to work for a place like them. And I think the nice thing about them too is Greenhouse functions as almost a boutique agency. I mean, right now it's Chelsea and I. We'll probably be bringing someone else on board in the not too distant future. But yeah, we function as a small boutique agency, but we also have the backing of Contracts People, which is our sister company, and they really work very closely in our contracts with us. They're experts in the business. And Rights People, which is a rights agency that sells our rights internationally. And so we have these great advocates helping us with those parts of our jobs. It just kind of seemed like a no-brainer to me for a lot of reasons. And Chelsea, who has taken over, is just, she came from the editorial side of things too. She was at Random House for many years. And she's just kind of an agenting phenom who just kind of came out the gate, with big books and big auctions, and has just really taken over in such a wonderful way, and just really knows this business incredibly well. I'm so lucky to work with her and have her as a mentor. The other thing to mention too, I mean, between Sarah and Chelsea, Sarah Davies represented When You Trap a Tiger, which of course won the Newbery, and sold it to Chelsea when she was an editor. And they were both working together at the agency when it won the Newbery. So that, I mean, you know, that was just sort of the cherry on top of, like, these two have incredible taste. And yes, I would like to work with these people with these amazing brains. I think it's a great agency to be at. We're in a real place of growth right now, which is really exciting. I think the next few years are going to be a really exciting time for Greenhouse as an agency as we kind of look to the future. The whole sort of ethos of Greenhouse is it's a place where writers grow, and we take the sort of greenhouse metaphor really literally. As I said, Chelsea also comes from an editorial background. We both love to do editorial development work with our authors. And that's, I think, also what gives us a leg up when we're selling projects, because editors know we have that background. They know projects have been developed to a certain degree before we are attempting to sell them. And I think it just makes the quality of our projects overall much stronger. So, I mean, that's a very long answer to your question of why Greenhouse, but yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of the perfect home for an editor in a lot of ways.
No, I love a long answer because now we get information that I'm not clever enough to ask questions to get.
Sure, yeah.
I should mention there have been so many wonderful moments in the history of running the blog, Middle Grade Ninja, and now the podcast. And so many times where I just kind of cocked my head a little bit more. Really? Somebody that famous, that important is gonna take this seriously. That's amazing. But one of those times was definitely when Sarah Davies agreed to be featured at the blog. You can go check out her interview at middlegradeninja.com, esteemed audience. And it was just like, wow, she's a legend and she's here. Incredible.
Yeah. And I mean, it's one of the things
here.
Yeah.
Kristen Nusby, a legend, and you're here.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think she's somebody to definitely try to mimic as I'm, you know, as I'm continuing on in this role as an agent. And she is somebody who, you know, was, you know, she was never too important for anybody's time. And I feel like this is an industry of relationships. And I take that very seriously too. I mean, one of the reasons I like this industry is because it's full of such wonderful people. So it's great to make new friends and talk to new people. And you know, I think people who are really successful in this industry are always willing to lend a hand and to have a conversation. And so I think Chelsea and I both kind of take that, are trying to take that mantle from Sarah as well.
So anybody that decides to sign with Greenhouse Literary is going to benefit from all of that experience. You've got the rights people, so you're going to be able to handle all the foreign rights, the film rights, is our audiobook rights. Are there any rights you're not going to handle?
No, I don't believe so.
And obviously editors know that the work they're going to receive from you is going to be pretty much ready to hit the printing press from day one, right? Because it's already going to be fully edited and developed.
I mean, you know, that would be great. I don't think it would be fair to set up an author with that expectation, but, you know, I think it'll definitely be hopefully that much closer. And that the, you know, every editor is going to have a different vision than another, so they may see things that they would like to change about a manuscript that weren't things that I prioritized or what have you, and so there's certainly going to be revision work after an editor takes something on board, but think, you know, with editors being as swamped as they are, a manuscript that's closer to being at its finished stage is just that much more appealing for sure.
And then I'm assuming because you've acquired books for the two different major houses, you know who is going to need to sign off on this book in order for it to get the green light. So you're crafting pitches to help them craft pitches to get who all needs to get on, marketing needs to get, who all needs to get on board in order for a book to be sold.
Yeah. So an editor will first, at least the way it worked at Simon & Schuster, and I think the way it works many places is an editor will take a manuscript they're interested in acquiring to their editorial meeting. Oftentimes either the full team or a few editors will read the manuscript or as much of it as they can and weigh in. And if it makes it past the editorial meeting, then it will go to the acquisitions meeting, which has representatives from sales and marketing and publicity. And editors have to prepare a lot of materials ahead of time for an acquisitions meeting, including, you know, crunching numbers to project sort of how they think it might sell, as well as, you know, crafting their pitch. So when you can hand an editor as an agent, when you can hand an editor sort of a, you know, a tagline or really strong comps that are performing well that will resonate with sales and marketing. Just like a good elevator pitch, when you can kind of arm them with those things, you're making the editor's job that much easier, which just, I think makes the whole process smoother.
And we talked about you were working obscene hours, I'm sure, as an editor at different times that just aren't conducive to having a family. As a literary agent, I'm assuming you're able to structure your day a little bit better so that you're making time for. It's so amazing how nobody I could tell non-parents a million times just how much a child is going to change all of your priorities and everything you've ever thought. And there's no way to 100% know until you have one. Like, oh my God, everything's different now. But I'm assuming that being a literary agent is something that you can work around your schedule a little bit more freely. What does your schedule look like now?
I work a pretty standard 9 to 5 or 9 to 6 day at the moment. But I can certainly be more flexible, which is great. I make my own schedule throughout the day. I have far fewer meetings. And I have, to this point anyhow, fewer emails than I did as an editor. My days just feel more flexible. As far as what the individual days or weeks look like, I try to get my reading done on Mondays and Fridays, and have meetings on my Tuesdays through Thursdays. But each day I start with reading queries. The rest of my time is filled with, of course, editing manuscripts, getting them ready to go on submission, writing my, submission pitch emails, and getting a project ready to go out, having Zoom calls or in-person coffees or lunches with different editors, and to try to keep those connections up or make new ones. And that's, I would say, the sort of the bulk of what I'm doing. But yeah, it is definitely a more flexible schedule than when I was an editor. There's no doubt about it. I think work from home has changed that, hopefully, for a lot of people, although, I know there are still just an incredible amount of meetings for editors right now. I am very thankful that it is a more flexible job overall, for sure.
Even if the meetings could just be over a camera like this, as opposed to let's go all the way to a location and sit down and make that, make the meeting 2 or 3 times as long as it would have been that way.
Sure. Yeah, I think that helps.
So Tuesdays and Thursdays are the meetings, Mondays and Fridays, you said that's when you're reading submissions. So if I were a querying author, it sounds like Monday morning, as early as possible, is the best time to send a query your way. Or I
That's a
guess
good
Monday night.
question.
So when you get to it.
That's a good question. I don't know that I would say, does it matter? I don't know. I feel like I would tell an author not to stress about that. I mean, I think, maybe it's possible that Monday morning is my freshest time to look at things, but I am looking every single day, so I don't know. I would say just send it when you're ready and don't stress about it. There's enough to stress about when you're sending your book out on submission.
Yes, why am I adding extra?
I
Fair
mean,
enough.
anything that gives a leg up, I get it, but I feel like for me, it doesn't make enough of a difference. But yeah.
Okay, so we won't impress you with our time, and how will we impress you with our query? What's going to grab your attention?
Yeah, great question. Very glad you're asking this. I know it's something we talk about a lot with authors, but it's still, I think, so great to remind folks how important it is to really, like, from the top, sort of make sure you are citing your comps, and making sure that your comps are applicable to the current marketplace, or at least the marketplace in the last 5 years. Making sure you're saying your book is, like, would sit alongside these titles on the shelf. Make sure that's in your, like, opening paragraph, as well as, your one sentence, or two sentence pitch, right off the top, being as strong as you can make it be. I mean, really, because we get so many queries, it's very important to make an impression right from the top, as opposed to expecting that an agent is necessarily going to make it to the very bottom of your pitch. And we, of course, do our best, but I think there are oftentimes things that people can do in the beginning of their pitch that can be turnoffs as well. And you want to make sure you avoid things like, getting too in the weeds on things that don't have to do with your story. We want to know about your personal life, but maybe save that for the paragraph at the bottom where you tell us your bio, as opposed to, explaining your personal reasons for writing this up top, if that makes sense. Like, I think just getting to, like, the nuts and bolts of it as quickly as possible is just so important when we have so many queries coming in.
Just turn your head if I say something insightful that I discovered about you online. Like, I saw you on the Middle Grade Ninja podcast. I heard you say the following thing. Does that turn your head and let you know that I've done my research, or would you prefer I just got straight to the pitch and then worry about the rest of it later?
I think it's good to know where you found me, if that's the case. And if something that I said, you know, resonated with you, then great, feel free to mention that. I would say that the thing that maybe where that like sort of dividing line is, you know, I think a lot of writers querying like to kind of quote you back at yourself and say, like, I saw in this thing you're looking for XYZ and my book is XYZ. Sometimes that can feel a little bit like they're trying really hard to connect you with their story before they'd actually told you about their story, if that makes sense. I feel like I'm being a little nitpicky there, but
Does that make sense? You're the one going to be making the decision. Tell us all the nitpicks.
I mean, I think I guess what I'm trying to get at is you want to make sure you're sounding authentic and don't feel like you have to, like, you know, quote somebody's wish list back at them, because they know what they're looking for. You don't have to remind them, right? So, like, but yeah, if you found me on the Middle Grade Ninja podcast, and, you know, and there's some, if there's something that we have that's a personal connection, like we're both from Michigan or whatever, like, feel free to mention that. That's kind of fun for me to know. But I would say don't go too far into like trying to do all that upfront. Like, a quick mention is great. And then, you know, tell me about your book, because that's what I'm really here for.
Or if I could tell you, you and I were talking before we got started about one of my favorite authors and favorite people, Jessica Lawson.
Yeah.
And I know you edited her books, all of them, haven't you? Most of them?
Her first three books, yes. Yeah.
So if we were to mention that Jessica Lawson, author of the Truthful Adventures of Becky Thatcher, Nooks and Crannies, and many others, check her out. Check the back catalog, esteemed audience, for my conversation with Jessica Lawson. I promise it's worth your time. So if we were to say, hey, I've written something similar to Jessica Lawson, which all lies, because nobody, only Jessica Lawson can write Jessica Lawson. But if we mention that, hey, you like this particular author, would that turn your head a little bit toward us?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, for sure. If somebody felt like their book comped well to somebody that I had worked with, definitely I would say bring that up. Yeah, that cannot hurt at all. And I think also, you know, it helps to know that somebody, you know, I think if you know that somebody has, if the books I've edited resonate with a writer, it means there's a greater likelihood that, you know, I may enjoy their work. So sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so that would at least set your appetite for, oh, I might be about to get something enjoyable here. I'll read the whole pitch rather than giving up after the first terrible sentence.
Yeah, I would say, again, like, keep that kind of a mention, like, brief, and then get to your story. But by all means, yeah, feel free.
Okay, so obviously the pitch has to stand on its own. Ideal pitch for you, you want two sentences, those are the strongest up front, or how would you, what's the ideal pitch look like?
The ideal pitch for me is where your first two sentences, it's hard to get too specific about this because I think there are definitely different ways to do this. But the things that really hit home the most for me are the people who have a great, like, one sentence, you know, elevator pitch that's like, you know, sort of does something to express the tone of the story, what might be at stake, and then follow that sentence with, you know, what the comps might be, you know, or that could be one or two sentences, whatever it might be. There's not like a specific number I feel like I need to see. But yeah, you know, like I like to think of like taglines on the front of a book. Like if you can write a great like tagline up front that might hint about what the story's about, like that's a really great way to start. Yeah, does that make sense?
It does.
Okay.
I know that you're going to be looking mostly at electronic queries, but I can see there's the start of a fireplace behind you. I like to imagine you reading old-fashioned mailed queries and like three sentences to the fire next.
Yeah, I'm definitely not like, I'm not that picky. I think as long as I know that you've done your homework and you know how to get my attention right away with your story. Like, that's the important thing. Because if you can write a great query letter, the chances are your pages are going to be really strong too. You know, if you've clearly done your homework, it means you've also probably done the homework in your craft and in your work on your manuscript. So the query letter does really matter.
Gotcha. So, okay, so author gets past that, but got you hooked with the pitch. Next thing you look at is, do you go straight to their pages? You go to their bio? What are you looking at next?
So, after the query letter or?
Yeah, after you've read the pitch and you're like, oh, this sounds like 100% a great story that I'm going to be interested in. What's the next thing you look at to evaluate whether you want to see this full manuscript? Do you look at the author's bio? You visit their website?
Sometimes, occasionally I will visit a website. The bio is always interesting to me. Although, you know, there's not like a formula for what makes a good author. So that's mostly just like really interesting for me to know. And of course, if they have published works, that's also helpful and might make me interested to look further. Or if they have, you know, a degree in writing or what have you, that can't hurt to know. But for me, honestly, I really like to get to the pages. So if your pitch has captured me, I will often request the full and just see what happens because, you know, the projects that I've signed so far have been the stories I've opened up and haven't been able to put down. So I often don't even really bother with like, you know, the 10 page sort of sample. I like to kind of get the whole thing because if I'm able to have the experience of just wanting to like plow through a story, like give me that opportunity, I'd love to do that. And it's, you know, once you dig into the writing, it's pretty easy as an agent to get a sense of whether this person's writing holds up or not.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So, I mean, whether I send you 10 pages or 50 pages, once you hit something that makes you go, oh, well, this isn't going to be well done, then you're out the other way, right?
Yeah. I mean, pretty much. And that sounds, I feel like that sounds, I know that's tough on a lot of writers, right? Because like getting the beginning right is so hard. And so, but the truth of the matter is with the number of queries coming in, you can't really expect someone to wait till page 50 to really get sucked in. Like you kind of need to get them, you know, right off the bat, at least with your writing. The story doesn't necessarily have to be perfect, but I think I know my taste well enough to know whether I connect with the writing more or less in the first few pages.
I'll keep going. Page 99, a stranger comes to town.
Yeah, right, exactly.
We'll never get there into the fire with this one. Under the... Fair enough. So, okay. So assuming that an author, you have the full manuscript, you've read it, you love it. What happens next? Do you arrange for a phone call? Are you checking out the author's social media?
I will often check out social media. I will often do a little bit of like internet research on a person. Just to make sure there are no red flags, really. But the next important step is, yeah, getting on Zoom is what I've been doing and having a conversation to see if we'd be a good fit.
Kind of red flags would show up on social media that authors should be mindful of?
That's a great question. I feel like it's the same kind of things that might apply if you're like, say, like, you know, you're in the dating world and you want to make sure someone isn't, you know, questionable sort. I feel like there's not one thing, but you want to make sure someone seems like a reasonable person and that there aren't, I don't know that I'm trying to think of specific red flags. I think it's just sort of getting a general sense of them. I mean, I think people's social media can tell a lot about, you know, the kind of person someone is, and hopefully they seem like good people.
Well, we keep hearing about these morality clauses. I know a few publishing professionals brought it up on this show, and I'm sure you probably encountered some at this point. So are you looking for types of things that, well, I know that would violate this morality clause over here, so that would definitely be an issue?
I mean, I think it's one of those things where for me, it's more of a, like my sort of, I want to make sure that the clients I'm working with, that their, you know, their values align with mine more or less. I feel like that's kind of more the thing I'm thinking about. And hopefully that avoids any conflict with the morality clause as well. I mean, at the end of the day, like these are people that I will be working with and supporting, and I want to make sure I feel good about supporting those people. And in a way, they're, my clients are going to be the kind of people who might be, you know, a friend in the non-publishing world, because I want them to be people that I feel like are trustworthy and good people and have their hearts in the right place. Which is, sounds sort of like vague maybe, but I think that's kind of what it comes down to for me is just feeling like a person is a good person, based on sort of, I guess, my definition of that.
And yet some of our best writers have been terrible. So
it's true. It's true. And you don't always know, right? I guess you don't always know. And there's always, you never know. But hopefully that's not the case.
So, okay. And I'm trying to give esteemed audience all the tips they need to nail this. So when you get to the Zoom call,
yes.
What's that look like? What types of things are you looking for the author to say that's going to assure you they're going to make a great client?
Yeah. I mean, I think someone's willingness to be collaborative, I think, is the most important thing. So what I like to do, you know, first I love to just have a getting to know you conversation where we talk about, you know, I introduce myself, I tell them about my agency and who I am, my background, and I ask them about their own background and who they are, because I want to get to know them as people. You know, and so just that getting to know you part of it is the initial portion of that call, really. And then yeah, we'll talk about their story, what I loved about it, what I see that might need some work, and are you willing to work on these things with me? Because I think if someone is resistant to wanting to be collaborative, and that's a huge red flag for me. You know, if someone feels like this is my story and I'm not gonna, you know, I don't really wanna, I'm not like our visions don't align, for example, like that's also a possibility too. Like maybe what I want to do with the author's story is counter to their own vision for it, in which case, you know, I would hope that they would speak up for what they actually want to, because you know, something that's super important in the relationship with an agent and an author, as well as an editor and an author, is it is a collaborative relationship. It's not, I want an author to always make sure that they are standing by their story firmly too, and that they're willing to give and to work on things, but that, you know, I'm here to help them stay true to their story. And if I'm not able to do that, if my vision is different from theirs, then they should also know that this is not maybe a good fit. So definitely is hopefully a conversation that goes both ways. And I think, you know, the advice that you're given when you go into a job interview of, you know, you're not just being interviewed, you're interviewing them, I think is so important. And I want to know that the clients I want to work with, they should also be holding me to a high standard. And they should also be asking me questions and making sure that they feel like I am going to be the right person to represent and support them, and that they are going to feel safe with me. So I would definitely encourage authors to ask as many questions as they want to ask in those conversations, for sure.
What are some good questions that authors should be asking?
I mean, one that I always get is about communication style, which I think is important to know. Just to make sure that, you know, some people need more support than others, and it's good to know what your client might want or need as well. I think it's, there's some other good questions that an author might ask me. I guess what the process might look like going forward, you know, what the timeline might look like for getting their project out on submission, how involved they can be as far as the submission list goes, and like which editors it's going to. I try to be really transparent about who I'm sending to, and if they have thoughts on the submission list, I'm more than, you know, happy to hear them, because sometimes an author may have a connection on social media with an editor somewhere, or they may have expressed interest at some point at a conference or what have you. So like asking about that part of it is really important too. I'm sure I'm forgetting important things that they could be asking me, but really, I don't think there's any question that should really be off the table. I mean, that's an author's biggest chance to make sure it's going to be a good fit. Cause it's a commitment. And certainly if it doesn't work out, they can walk away from it, but I think it's important for them to be good advocates for themselves. I know it's a daunting thing probably to get on the phone with an agent for a lot of people. But I would say to try to, do your best to just make sure you're looking out for yourself in those conversations too.
Well, these are middle grade and young adult authors. Daunting is facing an entire school of kids who've read your book and have questions.
For sure. Absolutely. No question. They're not going to hold back. Yeah.
So talking about the author age or author, I'm sorry, agent client relationship, what is your ideal for communication with an author? How often would you like to be in touch? What sort of things should we be in touch about?
Yeah, so I try to always get back to an author that day, or if I'm not able to that day, and this is over email, then the next. I mean, certainly if someone sends me revised pages or a new manuscript, I'm letting them know right away, like, I've received this, I will get back to you, you know, at X time. And for me, I think, you know, I'm here to support my clients. So if there's something that they need, if they're feeling like they need some reassurance about something, or they need my help with something, or they're stuck in a part of a revision they need my assistance with, like, I want to hear from them and I want them to reach out to me. I do try to keep things contained to work hours. So, because I have, you know, two little kids, I'm not going to be on email at, you know, 11 PM. So, you know, I try to keep things to work hours, and I think, that's just healthy for everybody, I think. But of course, if there's an emergency, you know, then there's an emergency. And if there's an auction happening, then that may change too, because we're going to need to potentially be in touch outside of the regular workday. And there are certainly times with revisions too, where we're trying to get something ready to go out, where we may be, you know, communicating later on in the day. But generally speaking, I mostly just try to be as available as possible within reason, and as communicative as I can be about when I will not be able to be communicative. So if I know I have two manuscripts on my plate right now, and you just sent me yours, I'll say, like, hey, this is what's going on. I've got these two others. I'm going to have to wait till next week to get to yours. Like, you know, would you mind holding tight? Just being really clear, I think, and upfront, so that everyone's, I think, managing expectations is the important part of the communication process with me and my clients.
I'm assuming emails and text will mostly suffice for the vast majority of communications, as opposed to, here's a random phone call at 5:59. I know it's not 6 o'clock yet. Let me call you.
Yeah. I mean, I don't mind a phone call. I'm old fashioned that way. I still love a phone call. I would say for me, emails and phone is the best way to go. But yeah, I mean, you know, if someone is having a hard time and needs support, like, yeah, give me a call, you know, keeping it within the workday is great. But I think most people tend to be pretty respectful about that, at least in my experience so far.
And then as far, I'm assuming you want to manage authors, not just through one book, but for their career, right?
Yeah.
What kind of conversations do you have, and what kind of career, how do you go about talking with an author and making sure everybody's got reasonable expectations for what that career is going to look like?
Yeah. I mean, I'm glad you asked that. And that's something too, that I think on the initial agent call, is an important thing to talk about. And I always try to bring up is, you know, sort of what someone envisions for their career. And I think they should make sure that their agent is looking at that too, as opposed to just thinking about the one project. But yeah, I mean, for me, I try to have those conversations, you know, not irregularly. I mean, I think having regular conversations about what they see coming next, what they want to focus on next, is really important, and always having in mind the sort of long-term goal. You know, some authors are in the back of their minds thinking about eventually writing a novel for adults. And I love to know that, because I think it gives me an idea of what might be coming and what I might be able to help them work on with. And also for me to then, you know, start thinking about how to help them pivot, and how to start thinking about if they are, for example, going to write something for adults and they want to write an adult thriller, like, who are the right editors in the adult world for that, and just start thinking ahead. So I think that it's really, I think, an ongoing and constant conversation. I think something an author should never shy away from bringing up, because I think an agent should be able to strategize with their clients and think about what those next steps might look like to get them there.
And if somebody's thinking about writing for adults, or if the thought is, hey, I'm going to write three beautiful middle grade books and then erotic thrillers, is that something where that would maybe change whether or not you're the right agent for someone like that who's going to be working in such a vastly different genre?
Potentially. Yeah, I mean, it's good to know. I think it'd be good to know, especially if it was something I felt like I was not at all qualified to work on for whatever reason. Yeah, I think it's good to be upfront about that kind of thing. It can never hurt. And I think if the relationship is solid enough, and if the writer is, if I have enough faith in the writer to, you know, branch out in different ways, like I would love to be the person to help them to do that. And I think, you know, there's also the possibility that, you know, that's a fork in the road that we might get to at a certain point, and then there are conversations to be had. But I think all like honesty and transparency, you could never go wrong.
And for the record, I actually do know some middle grade authors who also write erotic thrillers, and they're wonderful.
Amazing.
Great. They're some of the best people on earth.
Of course they are. Sure they are. Yeah.
Well, you know, I am biased, because anytime somebody tells me they're an author, like, you could tell me someone murdered 30 people, and but they did it because of a frustrations over an unpublished novel. Aww.
Oh, I see.
It couldn't have been all bad. Well, I'm looking at our time, and it's flown by. Where did it all go? But I did want to ask you about your freelance writing, because you had one of my dream jobs from childhood. You freelance wrote some Mad Libs. What is the process for writing an official Mad Libs book?
So I was fortunate enough to edit them, and was fortunate enough to work with one of the co-creators of Mad Libs, Leonard Stern, who was like a writer for like 60s late night television and Love Boat. And anyway, and so I was able to work with him on how the process of writing Mad Libs really works. And it's really about joke writing. And I feel like I got a great crash course in joke writing through being able to edit those and then write them as well. But yeah, I mean, they're a very specific sort of the guidelines for writing them are very specific, and you know, there are a certain number of blanks you're supposed to use as far as your parts of speech throughout, and I think one of the things I always found the most interesting about them was that it's not just about writing a sentence and removing words from them. It's about crafting the sentence around the joke. So it's great to play with like idioms, like life is a bowl of cherries, and to remove, you know, cherries is your plural noun, and, you know, life is a bowl of, I don't know, pine nuts is the weird thing that came to mind. But like when you plug in something funny into an existing, you know, known phrase, that's when they tend to get really funny. I think that's just a good like joke writing note, is to play with the unexpected, to play with the expected, and then to sort of subvert it a little bit. So yeah, I mean, I could talk about Mad Libs forever, because they're so close to my heart, and it was a ton of fun writing them. I haven't done it in quite some time, but I always found them very satisfying. I loved to play them as a kid, so it was like a dream to be able to do that.
Do you obviously you've got your hands full with aging and everything else, but do you anticipate doing more writing eventually?
I would like to. I sort of do it for fun, like on the side. I mean, I'm always journaling or writing terrible poetry or what have you, but I do really enjoy writing. But yeah, I would love to one day write a novel, and I feel like eventually there will be the time that comes for that. Yeah, I mean, I feel like everything that I do really just revolves around just words and language and my love of it. And basically any way I can utilize that, including writing, is something I would love to do. But yeah, I'm sure at some point I will approach that when the time is right.
And then esteemed audience knows I'm going to ask, because I ask everyone who comes on this show, Kristen Ospie, have you ever seen a ghost or a flying saucer?
So I have never, to my knowledge, seen a ghost, but I suppose it could have happened without me knowing. As far as a flying saucer goes, there was one time when I was a kid in my childhood bedroom at night, and I looked out the window and saw something weird in the sky with flashing lights that was not a plane. I don't know what it was. It could have been some kind of aircraft that I was not familiar with at the time, but it freaked me out a lot as a kid. So possibly. But you know, I'm sure there's some rational, reasonable explanation for whatever it was that I saw.
Were you easy to freak out as a kid?
Was I easily freaked out as a kid? Yeah. I mean, like, I feel like anyone with an imagination, you know, I think it's easy to get freaked out because you can create all kinds of stories that can terrify yourself. But sure. Yeah. I don't know that I was any more freaked out than anybody else. But, you know, late at night when it's dark out and you're alone with your thoughts, I think it's easy to spook yourself a little bit.
That's very true. The imagination is all fun and games during the day, but at night, right before sleep, oh, Lord.
Exactly.
This has been an absolute privilege and a pleasure, and I so appreciate your making the time for me and making the time for esteemed audience. My final question for today, although you're going to write that novel, then you're going to come back and we're going to talk about that. But for today, my final question is, if there was some bit of advice that you could impart to every writer who's watching or listening to us now, what would you want them to know? And feel free to include as many bits of advice as you like.
Okay. Wow. That's a big question. I would say trusting your gut is so important as a writer, and getting in touch with your own inner voice and being as authentic as you can in what you write is the best thing you can do for yourself. I think it's really easy to get lost in advice. I think it's really easy to think you want to have to be like somebody else to make it as a writer. But I think when you can really get in tune with what you want to express and give yourself the tools to be able to do that, I think you're going to be the best writer you can be. And I feel like that sounds sort of vague, but I think ultimately, like, really knowing yourself is really important to being a good writer. And gosh, what else? I don't know. I have to think for a second here if there's something I want to say that's... Yeah, I think just getting back to sort of the idea of being your own advocate when you're in the process of looking for an agent, like trying to remember that you're the one with the talent here. You're the one with the gift here. You know, I think there's a, basically just being, not being afraid to stand up for what you think, for what you need and what you want to express. I feel like we may have to like edit this a little bit because I'm getting a little bit off track here, but I think it's more just about, yeah, not being afraid to be your own best advocate when you're a writer. Yeah, as far as specific advice, like I feel like I'm struggling a little bit there because I feel like it's really person to person. Like I feel like every different person could probably use very different advice, you know?
No, I want one size fits all guarantees.
Yeah, it's a toughie. Writing is hard. I mean, it's a really hard thing to do what your audience is trying to do and getting published. And your audience is doing all the right things by doing their research and paying attention to the market and what's out there, what's working, what editors and agents want. And, you know, I think that can never hurt. But I also think it's really easy to get lost in the noise of the conversations on social media. And so I think that's kind of what I'm getting at as far as, like, you know, being true to yourself and what you want to express, because that's the best way to be unique and new and fresh as a writer, I think.
I think that's the perfect note to end on. Where can esteemed audience find you online, follow you on social media and all that good stuff?
Yeah, so I am on Twitter, which I don't use very frequently, but I'm at Kristen Ostby on Twitter. And that is the best place to find me in my sort of like publishing persona. And then you can find out more about me on Greenhouse Literary's website, which is greenhouseliterary.com. You can find my bio there and my wish list and the link to find me on Query Tracker to sub to me. Yeah, but thanks so much for having me today. I hope that your esteemed audience gets something useful out of this. And it's been really great getting to chat with you today.
Well, I tell you what, anybody who's been listening to our conversation for the next year, if you send a query to Kristen Ostby and you mention the Middle Grade Ninja podcast, I guarantee you will be in her inbox. So that's a promise.
Perfect.
For more tremendous conversations, almost as tremendous as this one, with other literary agents, authors, editors, all the world's best people, head to middlegradeninja.com. Download your free copy of Banneker Bones and the Giant Robot Bees. Will change your life. And God will get them alive. I'll see you next week.